This is the State of Things from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Location scouts for the film trilogy Hunger Games needed just the right place for District 12. They wanted a place that said hardworking, tight-knit community, while also saying poor and ravaged. They chose the Henry River Mill Village in Catawba County. It's a collection of houses and common buildings that's been abandoned for 100 years. Mill villages were once a common feature of the North Carolina landscape, from Appalachia to the eastern counties. Here in the Triad, the Pomona Company operated a pipe factory about 5 miles outside of downtown Greensboro. The pipe was made of terracotta, and the village where the factory workers lived was called Terracotta. The factory closed down in the 1970s, and much of the village was sold off. But what's left is still inhabited, and now there's an effort to turn the village into a living history museum. Dennis Waddell is the force behind that effort. He lived in Terracotta as a child, is now the founder and CEO of Terracotta Heritage Foundation. Dennis Waddell. Benjamin Filene is the director of public history at UNCG and associate professor of history at UNCG. He has led an effort to document the memory and the legacy of the Terracotta Village. Benjamin Filene, welcome to the show. Good to have you. So, Dennis, let me ask you first. You were born in Terracotta, and you were there as a child. What was it like to live there?
Well, as a child, living in Terracotta was probably one of the greatest experiences that I could recall. It was a community where almost everyone in the community was related to each other, and therefore you had the guidance and support of everyone, your neighbors, the people who sold you things at the store, as well as the extended family. So I, as a child, I thought it was an excellent place to live.
How many people were living there at the time?
Now, at the time, Terracotta consisted of roughly 100 houses that were all company-owned houses, very similar to all of the mill towns in the U.S. at that time. Most of the houses were of poor quality. They had no electricity, no running water, no sewer. And so it was up to the community to kind of learn how to live with meager means.
And what was your family's relationship? Did they work at the plant?
Yes. One of the things is that in order to even live in the community of Terracotta, you had to work at the plant that produced the Terracotta pipe. And I want to make it clear that Terracotta itself was not the name of the community. Terracotta was just the name of the plant. The plant was called Pomona Terracotta Pipe Company, and it was in the unincorporated town of Pomona, which is about 5 miles outside of Greensboro. And the workers who worked at the Pomona Terracotta Pipe Company start identifying themselves as, oh, I live in Terracotta, as if Terracotta was a physical location. What in our minds it became so.
And Benjamin Filene, of course, this is a common feature. Give us a sense of the mill community, the mill town in North Carolina, and what it was like, what the landscape was like at that time.
Well, I think it was really common in that these industries needed workers. And one way to get them and to have them at hand and to have them have their schedules be to some extent under your control was to build housing for them right on the scene. And I got interested in this from doing work on the textile mills in Greensboro, where the Cone Mill Villages, the Cone Textile Factory had housing for each factory immediately adjacent. And this was an extension of that same approach here at Terracotta, where these were segregated villages. Terracotta was an all-African-American community built for the workers there, and it sustained the economy for generations.
Now, how well, of course, we know Cone Mills, how well known was the Terracotta Pipe Company, and when did you first find out about it? Was this a bit of a surprise for you to know that this particular community existed?
Well, it's one of those interesting things. It was a surprise to me. Of course, it wasn't a surprise to people who lived that whole life. And I think that's a really instructive lesson that one of the things I've gotten out of this is to recognize how many stories there are like this that are just beneath the surface and just haven't been given a public hearing. And that's why Dennis's work to preserve and save and disseminate these stories is so important. I heard about it through Dennis's work. I was doing work on the textile mill villages, and someone said, you should really go check out what this guy's doing just down the road. And it opened up a whole world that I had known nothing about.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the village itself and the history, because the mill did at first build that village, but then they sold some land and there was a second. Tell us the history and how things changed.
Okay, the first thing I'd like to do is invite people who are members of groups or organizations to go to the website, Terracotta Heritage Foundation, and you'll learn about the community, as well as recognize that myself trying to save the history of the community is looking for people to help me support that effort. So those of you who represent organizations or groups or churches or whatever, I like to just let you know that Terracotta was a community that was started in 1886 by the Bourne brothers, who were the managers of the plant. And their desire was to make a product to take away the sewer and wastewater from the major cities of the South. And so they built this plant knowing that, learning that terracotta, the material terracotta, which is, by the way, means red clay, that was had been for years proven to be an excellent product to handle waste. And so when they started the plant, it required a lot of labor. Because the Bourne brothers, I believe, was of the Quaker religion, they were not averse to hiring blacks. So many of the people who worked the hard labor of the plant were blacks who had come to that area by way of South Carolina, and therefore in their migration up north, remember this is the late 1800s, they got a job, therefore they would tell their cousins, their brothers, and eventually the workforce of the community consisted primarily of people who kind of knew each other. And my efforts now is to save that community, because in 1962, the community ended up not existing any longer for a number of reasons, which we'll talk about. But my thing now is to preserve the heritage and history of the families who lived there, because, as I said, all of them were related, and I am documenting every family, roughly about 200 of them, and I am also trying to assist the current few families that live there.
Well, it's an interesting story, too, because you're both an insider and an outsider. You moved away as a young man,
yes,
didn't you?
Yes.
So tell us about that. You moved away at around 9 or 10 years
yes,
old.
Yes. When I was 9 years old, I had a brother who drowned at the Terracotta Pond. The pond, by the way, was used to collect water to make the terracotta pipe. And he went swimming one afternoon in April 1954, and he unfortunately drowned. And in our community, the elders are a driving force. So the elders of the community convinced my grandmother, who I lived with along with my mother and other brothers and my sister, those elders convinced her that, you know, things happen in threes around here, so you better watch Dennis. And so the next thing I know, when school started that following year, I found myself shipped from the community that I knew as a youth to Baltimore, Maryland, where my mother had migrated earlier during the great migration of blacks from the South going up north looking for employment. So that's how I ended up getting out of the community, and I stayed in Baltimore, but came back to the community of Terracotta every summer as soon as school was out. And at that time, I recognized the community that I lived in, I just missed so deeply, and my grandmother would keep me informed during the time that I was out of the community by way of letters letting me know, you know, Mary got married, or Johnny, he went in the military. And so I was keeping a running history of what was going on
in the
community.
And you still have those letters. They're
yes,
an important part of the collection now, aren't
yes.
they?
Yes. And the thing is, after I left the community and graduated from high school, I went back to A&T, came back to Greensboro, where I graduated from A&T University, and it was just a desire of mine after I retired to document and collect the history of that community.
We will find out more about the history of that community, Terracotta Village outside Greensboro, was outside Greensboro, with Benjamin Feline, UNCG, and Dennis Waddell from the Terracotta Heritage Foundation. Our conversation continues after a short break, but first, here's Layla Noor. She's going to be with us here at the Triad Stage. She's going to play us out in 1 second before I tell everybody that this is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's Layla Noor. This is the State of Things broadcasting from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about Terracotta, a village about 5 miles from downtown Greensboro, built by workers at the now-defunct Terracotta Pipe Factory. Benjamin Feline is with me. He's Director of Public History at UNCG and an Associate Professor of History at that same place. Dennis Waddell is here as well. He is the founder, I should say, and CEO of Terracotta Heritage Foundation. Joining us now is Eugene McMurray, a resident of Terracotta, and Eric Noble, Elizabeth Baker, and Ellen Kuhn, who are graduate students at UNCG. Welcome to all of you. Eugene McMurray, let me ask you, you worked at the Terracotta Pipe Factory. What did you do there?
Well, I tipped mud, and I made pipes, flue line, drain tile, running machine. I've done some of everything. I worked on a belt, checked bricks, and I've done most of everything that could be done at Terracotta except lifting those heavy pipes. I wasn't able to lift those.
What was it like to live in that community?
It was nice to me. I was born there, and I was raised, and I went to school at Terracotta. I know just about everything that ever happened in Terracotta. I know about it.
One of the great things about living in a community like that is, of course, the downside, I guess, as a kid is everybody knows everybody's business. So
yes.
You got a lot more parents than you really need at that age. Huh?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. But I enjoy staying at Terracotta, and I hope I can stay there the rest of my life. because everybody that's my age that worked there is dead and gone. Now I'm about the only one that's living in my age.
Part of the reason that the plant is no longer there is that in the 70s there was an explosion at the plant.
Yes.
Never really came back. You were at the plant during
there.
The explosion. What was that like?
It was bad. That day, it seemed as it looked like it was dark. That dust was flying every which way. The boiler blowed up. Killed four people there. And just happened, the building I was next to the building, but most of the stuff went the other way instead of coming the way to where I was at. I was on the belt checking bricks. I never will forget that day. It was a Thursday at 10:30 in the morning in 62 when that explosion happened. And it was bad that day. And then they closed down. Then we had to go home and draw unemployment for a while, for about a month or two. And so they started back to working, and they started using steam press, automatic machines, making those pipes. And it was really rough at that time. And we didn't have no money much, It was hard to get something to eat, but we finally made it, though, by the help of God. We did that.
Was there any fear? What was the reaction in the community? There might have been a fear, was there, that the plant wouldn't come back?
Yes. Yes, a few of them. Few of them was there. But a lot of them left, and they got rid of a lot of them because they didn't need them anymore. Mm-hmm. After the machine blew, the steam part blew up, they didn't need them anymore. So it was kind of just kept a few, and I was one of the ones that they kept,
Well, Dennis, what happened after that? The plant did come back, but ultimately the plant closed down. What caused the plant to close?
Well, what happened after the explosion, it got clear to the company that economically other products had come along. You had steel and you had plastic to replace terracotta, which was a very fragile product, even though it was good for using as sewer pipe. And it became in the best interest, economic interest of the company to pretty much close the housing down at first, because don't forget the housing had no running water, electricity, or sewer. So the city of Greensboro by this time had expanded its boundaries. And in order for those houses to continue to exist, the owners of the plant would have had to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars. And because they now have a new product that's coming on, plastic and steel, then you couple that with the fact they just had an explosion. So it was in the best interest economically of the company to tear the whole works down and sell it off. But the thing that happened to the people, which was that they were dispersed. Imagine having a neighborhood of 100 houses, and within 2 years or less, every one of them is gone. All the people were dispersed throughout the city, throughout the state, and in many cases throughout the country. So in 2003, some of the existing residents had thought about, boy, it would really be nice to get back together with some of our old friends. And so they had what they called just a meeting. They'd come back and let's talk about terracotta. And they, when I use the word they, that is a very small segment of the people who lived in the community in 1927 were allowed to buy a piece of land to build their own houses. So when the company sold off everything, they couldn't sell this very small section, and that is what remained now. And those people decided it would be good to have a reunion, so to speak. So in 2004, the first reunion happened, and that became known as Terracotta Day, of which is now celebrated the Saturday before Labor Day every year. And we just had our 9th, so we will be celebrating our 10th coming up
And a couple of lucky breaks there. Number one, that in this case, workers were allowed to buy land, then build their own houses. Much of that, those houses, some of the pipe actually went into those houses, scrap and that sort of material. So there's terracotta in the houses. And then two, somebody like Dennis comes along to preserve it. But Benjamin Feline, there have got to be a lot of mill towns in this state that have just been utterly lost. Is that right?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, there are efforts to save them, but I think one of the challenges is how to save them in a way that preserves their vitality. And one of the things that's been interesting about this project is as my students have done oral interviews with the former and current residents of this community, they've started to see how memory can constitute community and that it can be a useful tool to make history ongoing and relevant and useful to the current needs of the community. And so this is an instance where saving it makes sense and actually impacts the current day lives of the residents and their descendants.
Because you also bring those stories together. So the intangible part of that community is kind of coalesces around the artifacts that you're able to save. So I want to talk to some of the students about what they've learned. Eric, you worked with two sisters who were part of the Lyles family. Is that right?
Yes, I did.
So tell us about them. Tell us about that family.
Well, they're sisters that grew up in the community. They grew up in a rather large house. I think what these sisters taught me most of all, or they at least redefined a simple word that we're all familiar with, and it's the word family. We're used to, at least my generation is used to having a family that lives under one roof, you know, that might consist of mother, father, children. But their family, they might have 30 people living under one roof. And it's family also extends outside of the walls of this home, even into the community. Whereas we were talking about earlier, you might have more parents than you really need at this time. But that's something that especially my generation has never experienced. And it's fantastic to speak with the Lyle sisters themselves to recount these memories and then preserve them.
Ellen, tell us about your experience because you've learned, among other things, about some childhood games that were played. I suspect games that you may not have known about.
Right. I interviewed a woman named Dot Glover, and she talked a lot about childhood and what it meant to grow up in terracotta. And one of the things that I loved hearing about was how resourceful and creative terracotta children were. They didn't have a lot of money to buy expensive toys, and so they found other ways to have fun. She described playing hide-and-go-seek, what they called 99 baseballs. So they'd call out, 99 baseballs, I can't see you, and then they'd have to go find each other. Climbing was a really big thing in the neighborhood. I guess trees in the neighborhood were really fun to climb. There was also an electrical tower that was kind of a dangerous sort of climbing thing. And they used whatever they had at home to be able to make all kinds of games. So you had everything from rocks and a ball, which were jacks, to corn cobs that you'd hollow out and attach a ball to, which is the game cup and ball. And so play was a really big part of growing up. And just the fact that they were so creative and resourceful in what they did, I think, is really different from my generation, where we expect to have everything handed to us.
And Eugene McMurray, kids weren't the only ones playing games. You were playing baseball, weren't you?
Yes, I played with Terracotta Hawk. I played shortstop sometime, second base. I really enjoyed it. We traveled a lot, and we played a lot with those Crutchfield boys and the Melvin boys over in Pomona. They played with us. We was the only team that back in that time had any white playing on our team. And we traveled a lot with them. And boys from Pomona, they went with us everywhere we go. They went in the park and played. Got along good. Pomona and Terracotta got along good.
You played against teams that were white, or you had white players?
We played against teams that were white and black.
Yeah.
Yes, and we had some white players on our team. Yes. Back in that time, it was kind of rough, you know, but we made it.
Got through. Did you have a sense then, growing up in a community like that with such a tight-knit community, people providing for themselves, did you have a sense of racial tension that was going on all around you?
No, I didn't, because it wasn't my one high school I could go to. That was Dudley High. And so it didn't bother me at all.
Elizabeth, tell us about the family that you talked with.
I was able to talk with the Hughes family, Paul and Betty Hughes, yes, and their daughter Sandra also. Betty Hughes has deep roots in North Carolina. She's lived here, and her family has lived here forever. Paul's family came over from South Carolina in the 1920s when his dad moved here to work at the pipe company. They lived at Terracotta on the actual company houses for about 13 years after they got married while Paul worked there. And then they were one of the families that was able to buy land and build their own house, and they've been living there ever since.
Do they talk about the people and the family and the community that has left and sort of missed? Do they stay in touch with people who've left, I guess?
I think they do stay in touch with as many people as they can, and the Terracotta Day celebration has helped them to do that a lot.
Yes.
But like Mr. McMurray said, a lot of their friends have passed away at this point, and so they tend to stay in closest touch with their children and their close neighbors right now.
Dennis, tell us about the church and the role that played in the community.
Well, in the community of Terracotta, there were two churches, a Baptist church and a Methodist church. When the company started the community, they left one house vacant, and it remained vacant from the very inception of the community. And in that one house, which today we would call a community center, the two denominations worship jointly. And then in 1905, the Methodist Church built its own church, of which the Baptist people would come and worship there. And in 1927, the Baptist people got enough money to build their own church. And so that community had two churches in it. However, one very unique thing about this community, they would close one church on the odd Sundays, and then the people from that church would worship at the Methodist church, and then the next Sunday the people from the Methodist church would worship with the Baptist church. So could you imagine that happening today?
Christians worshiping together?
That's right.
So it was the way it was.
So at least in Terracotta, 11 o'clock was not the most segregated hour.
That's exactly right.
That's right.
And the thing that we have going now, or just trying to make happen, is that currently, the people who live in that community are all over 80 years old.
Yes.
So the Terracotta Heritage Foundation has tried and set up a nonprofit organization, and we're turning the entire community into a living history. That is, I purchased a hayride wagon, and when I go out and talk to kids about Terracotta, and I would make a statement like, well, when I was a little boy, my grandmother used to hang the clothes on the line, and she put a clothespin on them, and then I'd see a little hand go up, and it would be some little kid say, Mr. Waddell, what's a clothespin? And from that, I recognize that in that community, I still have remnants of clothespin, washboards, the tubs that kids used to take baths in. So we're doing a Terracotta Heritage Tour where kids pay $10, get on a hayride wagon, tour the community, and see what life was like in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in a rural community. And so that's why we're looking for groups and organizations and foundations that want to help us do this. Our hope is to kick this off in March of 2013.
Eugene, what's it like for you to live in a place your whole life and then suddenly find that you are a history museum? I mean, what did you think when these these students come to you and say, hey, we're really interested in your house? They say, well, where
have
you been?
Well, I feel great about that, because that's something hardly happened to people. But I have went through a whole lot. I have tried to help people as much as I could. I always liked my children too. I like them. And my wife, we've been together for 62 years. You know I must love her. But anyhow, all I can say is that I really enjoy staying out there, and I hope I can stay there the rest of my life. Wow. In that house.
So tell us about, let me ask you, Benjamin Feline, the lesson from this. I mean, what do we learn? Because people are living there. And so what's the tension between a place where people are living their lives and yet a place we want to create that helps us remember the way things were and maybe aren't now?
Well, I think that's how history works at its best. I mean, is that there's not a gulf between past and present, but those are constantly in communication and conversation with each other, sometimes in tension, but you hope that history is something that you carry around with you that is part of how you make your decisions going forward. And that's the idea. Our contribution to this project that Dennis is doing is to open a new museum exhibition in the space that Dennis has created. And on December 8th, we're having an opening to celebrate that, and we're really hoping that it contributes to the ongoing project of memory there.
Tell us about the exhibition. What's going to be in it?
It's a assortment of photos, stories, interactives, and a small space. There'll be audio as well, a big emphasis on voice. I mean, as you hear from Mr. McMurray and from Dennis, that these people have stories to tell, and we're trying to amplify them and let them be heard, and also invite current and residents and their descendants to reflect on the importance of this, and then outsiders, people who may not have heard this story before, to learn something new and make some connections perhaps to their own communities, and what lessons can we learn going forward.
Well, let me put that question to Dennis Waddell. Certainly this has been important to you to preserve this one community, but what are the larger lessons of terracotta for the rest of us?
Well, I think people should recognize that history is generally told from the perspective of people who have power and wealth. When you go to a museum today, regardless of where you go, it's only the most powerful and the prominent people. But I am trying to tell the story from our point of view, because when I was a kid, they would talk about Custer's last stance, and we really don't know what happened there. Well, the problem is you could have learned what happened there. The only thing is you would have learned it from a different perspective, because it was about 5,000 Indians could have told you exactly what happened. But, of course, no one at that time wanted to hear their story from that perspective. So in the case of terracotta, we are telling our story from our perspective. It doesn't mean that the story is different. It just means that it's coming from another point of view, and I think it's a good educational point for all of us to understand, yeah, which is listen to what the other guy says about the exact same event. And so we encourage you and others to get involved in looking at life from a perspective of another person at some point in time, because you will see something different.
Dennis Waddell, thank you so much. The founder, CEO of Terracotta Heritage Foundation. Eugene McMurray is a resident of Terracotta. Benjamin Feline, Director of Public History at UNCG, Associate Professor of History there. Eric Noble, Elizabeth Baker, and Ellen Kuhn, grad students there. Public opening of the stories of the Terracotta community, 2 to 5 on December 8th at Terracotta Heritage Museum. For more information, check out terracottaheritagefoundation.org. We're going to take a break, but first, here's Layla Neuer. Layla.
Creepy way to